Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Can anything now stop Netanyahu from reshaping the Middle East in Israel's favor? Also, Putin seems to be suggesting Istanbul 2.0. Is that desirable? And will there be any takers? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Dmitry Babits. He is deputy foreign editor at Komsomolskaya Pravda Daily. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick this off with George in Budapest. We all remember in 2006 when Condoleezza Rice said that, and looking at events in Lebanon, is that we were witnessing the remaking, the midwifing the new Middle East, and we seem to hear echoes of that right now. Obviously, Israel has grand ambitions for the region, could only have those ambitions if the United States was behind it. It didn't work out in 2006. Is it going to work out this time, George?
Well, I very much doubt it, Peter. But it's interesting that when Condoleezza Rice said this in 2006, this was supposed to be an echo of the Bush administration's democratic ambition that they were going to spread democracy around the world. And of course, that came a cropper very quickly. What Netanyahu is now doing is trying to get as much out of the present crises in the Middle East that he has largely instigated as possible. And he has the wind in his sails because he has all these successes, which is that he's assassinated the leaders of Hezbollah. He's now got the assassination of Sinwar under his belt, and he's going to continue doing this. But it's clear that he, from everything that's happened over the past few days, that he has no intention of bringing anything to an end. So all of the talk from the Biden administration, including Harris, that this is an opportunity for peace, or this is an opportunity for bringing the hostages home. Well, Netanyahu does his usual thing, is, well, the hell with that. We're just going to pursue our own agenda, and we're going to try and get as much as we can. And we've still got the Iran attack on the back burner, and that's going to happen. There's no question about that. So Netanyahu, I think, sees this as an opportunity of just destroying and crashing and killing as much as possible, because he thinks that this is now an opportunity. He's not going to get this for a long time, to get as many of Israel's goals under his belt as possible.
And I would say that also applies, I'm going to throw this to Dima now, to the American administration, and it doesn't matter who's going to be in power in January, is that the United States sees this, Israel's behavior, activities, and even goals as perpetuating American hegemony in the region. And if there's a genocide here or there, it doesn't, that's the cost of doing business for the American administration. And that's how these two things dovetail. Does the United States want a genocide? Probably not. But if it furthers its goals in the greater Middle East or West Asia, so be it. Dima.
Well, of course, we are not going to hear from the United States or from Israel that we want genocide, That reminds me of Joseph Schumpeter's words about the Roman Empire. The empire has no legitimate opponents, only radicals and extremists. The empire has no foreign enemies, only crazy dictatorship ruled by insane individuals. I'm not sure I'm quoting correctly, but these are just corrections bringing it closer to our days, the idea of Schumpeter. So as Schumpeter wrote, Rome kept talking about peace, but somehow it was always involved in wars, because every new victory presupposed that you would have another war or another two or three wars. So in the same way, what we hear from the United States and from Israel, Yahya Sinwar is dead now. Now we can settle our scores with Iran. So one war is ended, the other one is begun. But the problem is the war in Gaza is not ended. I'm just astounded by the reaction of the American press to the assassination of Yahya Sinwar. So many supposedly intellectual people write that this is a huge achievement. Now we're going to have peace. You know, Hamas is decimated. These people having themselves a radical ideology, because what we have now in the United States and in the European Union is a radical ideology, which divides the world into democracies and autocracies, and which gives the democracies the right to assassinate people if they are supposedly held in autocracies. So these people having their own radical ideology, they deny the other ones the right to have any ideology. All the enemies are just crazy people, you know, crazy dictators who make other people's life miserable. So if you just take them out, which actually means killing them, murdering them by most cruel ways, yeah, right? If you just kill the leaders, the movement will die, because these people are unable to have an ideology. You know, they're supposedly, this is pure racism. You know, you deny your opponent the right to have his own logic. And that was just, you know, Wall Street Journal, they presented the biography of Yahya Sinwar, how he spent 23 years in jail in Israel for assassinating a Palestinian collaborator, how he learned Hebrew, how he watched Israeli television and kind of tried to understand the country he was fighting. And then in the end, the idea was that he was crazy, he was murderous, it's nice that we took him out. So you just described a romantic figure, you know, someone whom someone like Byron or Mary Mair would write a novel about in the early.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, because, you know, he was called the Lion of Gaza, and then they denigrated him. But the way he died actually showed that he was a heroic figure. I mean, it completely.
It doesn't mean that I personally like him, or that Russia was his ally, or that people admire him. He was, he did kill people, but, you know, the way the American media presents the full story is just ludicrous. You know, they're denying their opponents the right to have reasonable thinking.
Well, also, George, I mean, one of the biggest problems I've had in you and I talking on a regular basis, and obviously very regularly on this program, is that the way it's framed, and we're actually not enslaved to it, but I mean, we have to work around a Western framing of this. We use the word war. There's no war going on. It's slaughter. It's mass casualty event. That's just not a war, okay? What happened in Gaza, you can say, you know, Hamas will never be defeated. Well, maybe they won't be, but they have destroyed Gaza and a whole lot of other people. And with the intent to destroy Hamas is given the excuse to genocide people. We're seeing this also in Lebanon. We have to be careful of the language we use and not be captured by a Western narrative. George.
No, I agree with that. And it's very interesting, because that's the way Israel always fights its wars. Israel believes that it can treat everybody else other than the Israelis as insects. I mean, what do you do with insects? You stamp on them and just, you know, you kill however many, hundreds, thousands, whatever. You use your boot to kill all insects. That's how Israel regards its neighbors. It, of course, is not willing ever to sacrifice the lives of its own people. So what happens, therefore, is a particularly brutal, horrific massacre type of approach to war. Well, we're obviously not going to go in and risk our own lives. So what can we do? Well, we assassinate their leaders in the hope that this somehow will lead to something. Obviously, it never does, but no one has ever practiced this as rigorously as Zionists and Israel. It's always been their tactic. You know, way back before even the creation of Israel, they were always doing this assassination. And they were even in the British Mandate era, they were killing Palestinian leaders. So, I mean, this is how they do it. And then, of course, when that doesn't work, then you use the bombs, you know, you send in your missiles, you bomb them to smithereens against the people who have no means at all of defending themselves. But Israelis don't really care about that, because essentially, well, what does it matter? What do we care about then? You know, if they're dead, they're dead. Good. There's more land for us. So this is the way they go on fighting their wars. And this is what they're going to do now in Lebanon. And with Iran, they're obviously hoping to provoke a war there, war that would get the United States involved. I mean, so there's no question. I mean, if Israel and Iran start trading blows, the United States will get involved. I mean, the American officials have already made that clear that they will get involved. And then, of course, that they, you know, again, what kind of a war will this be? Well, you just keep pummeling away, just keep hammering Iran and say, well, what are you going to do about it? You don't have any nuclear weapons. You're going to just keep taking the punishment.
You know, Dima, we've just talked about here how the framing of conflicts, and this is a Western framing, and Israel is very pleased with it. They help frame that that discourse. But from the outside, looking at the global South, in a few days there'll be a large meeting here in Russia in Kazan. I mean, it's the West with Israel. It's a war on civilization. That's how it's framed around the world. But Western audiences never come across that framing.
Basically, the framing is very primitive. It's Hollywood style framing.
But Dima, it is very familiar to Western audiences because of its imperial past and its colonial past. And that's what really makes it quite pathetic, because the West has been humbled and shamed by its colonial history. But it doesn't seem to have the recognition that this is exactly what they're promoting all over again in the greater Middle East, West Asia.
Well, Israel behaves like a 19th century colonial empire. You know, not better, not worse. It just uses the more sophisticated technical devices, but basically the attitude is like us against them, subhumans. And Israel prides itself on being multi-ethnic, multinational. You know, people from Latin America, from Russia, from Poland, from Ethiopia. Even there. But colonial empires were also multinational. It was not just the French against the Arabs, you know, Jews. It was people from Italy, people from Spain. So in that sense, Israel is an exact copy of a 19th century colonial empire. But times have changed. So the West has become so hypocritical. The Western leaders keep telling Netanyahu, don't behave like us 100 years ago. Make a statement about, multiculturalism, something. And Netanyahu just doesn't do it. He tells them, you will have to do what I tell you.
This is what I'm saying. The West is embarrassed by the excesses. Yes. That's the worst for them. It's an embarrassment, but they won't stop it, okay?
But it's amazing. Did you notice how Netanyahu overcomes that embarrassment? He just kills another leader of Hamas or Hezbollah.
Because
Hezbollah.
He does know the U.S. will be... Gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We have to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns. I'm Peter LaBelle. Here we're discussing some real news. George, I want to switch gears here to what's going on in Ukraine. We had the former president of Ukraine, Zelensky, while exercising the power of the presidency in Ukraine, finally announced to his own people this time the victory plan, okay? So he went hawking it around through Europe and the United States. Didn't seem to get much traction. I mean, some attaboys, a little extra money, and it was a dud, okay? Though I would point out that the French foreign minister in the last news cycle said he backed it, which kind of astounded me. But, you know, as you and I have noticed, on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, it's one position, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, it's another. So I think that is an outlier. But George, where is it coalescing? Because we hear more and more from the Russian side. I think over the last 6 months, I think it's fair to say that the point of departure, the prism in which to look at how to resolve this conflict is through what was done in Istanbul in the first few weeks after the second part of this conflict. It started in 2014. It went a hot war in 2022. Istanbul 2.0, what do you think?
Well, that's right. This is something that Putin has returned to time and again, that somehow, well, we were close to an agreement at Istanbul. In fact, there were we already put initials on the agreement, and that any future agreement must be based on that agreement that was signed in Istanbul. Now, Putin has said other things. I mean, for us, in June, when he said, well, you know, the way we can get a ceasefire is if Ukraine withdraws from Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporozhye, gives up its ambitions to join NATO, then we get an immediate ceasefire. I mean, he didn't say that was the final settlement, but nonetheless, that was a suggestion. So by bringing up Istanbul 2.0, it is a little confusing because Istanbul 1.0 was by no means a good agreement. I mean, it still remains a mystery and really, you know, something that historians are going to be wondering about for years and years as to why Ukraine rejected an agreement that was obviously very, very beneficial to Ukraine and really not particularly good for Russia. But nonetheless, it was, you know, Johnson and NATO and everyone who just pushed him because at the core of Istanbul 1.0 was essentially Ukraine declaring it will not join NATO. That's a no membership of NATO, no foreign bases on Ukrainian soil, a limit on missiles and weapons and the scale of Ukrainian army, and that all the rest, you know, the future status of Crimea, Donetsk, Luhansk, everything that's just going to be kicked down the road. And there'll be no actual final settlement on any of those issues. That's something that will be up for negotiation between Putin and Zelensky. So it wasn't really a great deal for anyone other than Ukraine. In fact, Ukraine would have been better off than they were prior to February the 24th, 2022. Now I think that's, you know, any future agreement is just cannot be based on that. I don't think it can happen. I think it's given the state of the battle and what's been going on in the Donbass, it's much more likely that those aspects of Istanbul that were kicked down the road, which was the future status of those provinces, will probably be settled by fighting. But the rest, Ukraine and NATO, I think that's going to be much more difficult. I think without actually regime change in Kyiv, without some form of Russian occupation in Ukraine, I think it's going to be hard to keep Ukraine out of, even if, whether it's in a formal way or whatever, but to keep Ukraine out of those Atlantic political military alliances.
Yeah, because what I don't get about a possible Istanbul 2.0, Dima, is that Istanbul 1.0, Ukraine had not experienced a strategic defeat, a military defeat. Well, now it is experiencing a military defeat, and it is obviously experiencing a strategic defeat. So why would this, more or less the same terms and conditions of the first agreement apply to a possible second agreement? I don't, the reality on the ground is so completely different right now. I don't even know why it would be considered.
I think basically Zelensky does not want any agreement. He wants victory. If you look at his victory plan, I like the way Berliner Zeitung described it, referring to a person who saw the full text. He said it, the gist of it was, give me $20 billion in small banknotes, you know, in small notes, now and on my bank, you know, in the place that I indicate. And the story of Zelensky's trip to Europe is a star. You know, he was supposed to come to Rammstein summit meeting on Ukraine. And then his statements were so embarrassing about this so-called victory plan that somehow Biden did not come there because Biden said, I have this terrible hurricane. And the Rammstein summit was called off. But Zelensky did arrive there, didn't meet the boss there. So Zelensky went on a tour, visiting London, Paris, the Roman Pope. Then he returned to Germany. And then Biden came to Germany on Friday. And somehow Biden did not meet with Zelensky, even though Zelensky was there. He met with series, with Olaf Scholz, with Emmanuel Macron, and with Mr. Starmer from Britain, right? So it's obvious that Zelensky has become an embarrassment for Biden. You know, Biden doesn't want to hit him. But then what do we do with the famous phrase? No agreement, no talk about Ukraine behind the back of Ukraine, you know, without Ukraine being present in the room.
But what makes it even worse, Dima, let me throw that to George right now, is that In lieu of making some kind of gambit, just give him some more money and maybe he'll go away. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. Because
he's an embarrassment.
Because the West cannot accept a strategic defeat. They should, and it can be ameliorated by having a pan-European security agreement. That would say, let's have a win-win situation. You know, that's what we hear from these people. Let's have a win-win, but they can't even get that because Russia's involved here. So in lieu of trying to make a decision, just give them a little bit more money and maybe it'll just keep going.
No, I agree. I think that's the Western strategy, because the West, if you ask them, well, what's your plan? What is essentially, well, Ukraine to return to its 1991 borders and Ukraine becoming a member of NATO. I mean, this was said by the new NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Oh, Ukraine will be a member of NATO. Well, when you say that, you guarantee that the war goes on, because then Russia has no incentive at all for bringing this war to any kind of a conclusion, because then if you're, okay, well, as soon as it ends, NATO has said, well, the moment it's over, Ukraine is in NATO. So once that happens, well, why stop the war? And of course, that's really because, well, what is the NATO strategy? Well, we'll just keep it going, because we keep insisting on something that is clearly unacceptable to Russia. And they just keep saying this, the Ukraine will be a member of NATO, even though they know, and this is that Stoltenberg himself has admitted many times, that this is what caused this war. You know, but he, of course, boasts about it. Oh, well, you know, we stuck to our guns that Ukraine will be a member of NATO, and Russia got a war. So they're sticking to that line. Of course, that means there's going to be no peaceful resolution. And they will continue to, as you say, just pour more and more money and arms on this absolutely destructive, horrific enterprise.
You know, Dima, the Stoltenberg's gone. We have Rutte right now. But, you know, NATO likes to, it's boastful that, you know, we actually expanded the alliance during this conflict, you know. And, you know, they're all backslapping each other. But they never really consider, but how has that helped Ukraine? See, this is the tragedy of the situation. NATO, it's expanding. There's nothing to stop us. But You allowed your ally, Ukraine, to be destroyed in the process. So what's the ledger here? Was it a good thing or a bad thing? Dima?
Well, NATO expanded only formally after the hostilities deteriorated in Ukraine in 2022, because, in fact, de facto, Finland and Sweden took part in hundreds of military exercises together with NATO beginning from 2014. I can refer to Western press about it. So Stoltenberg is just saying that this situation allowed them to legitimize the de facto turning Finland and Sweden into open enemies of Russia. They were enemies.
Yes, but how does that? Okay, I agree with you 100%. But how has this helped Ukraine? How can NATO justify this policy when they say it's all about Ukraine, but it's everything but Ukraine?
But this is astounding. I mean, people, the media in Europe is now lionizing Biden, his great heritage, his great legacy. His legacy is Gaza and Ukraine, you know, and the legacy of Obama is the beginning of the civil war in Ukraine and Syria, you know, the destruction of Syria. The problem is that these people are never ready to admit defeat. They were defeated in Syria, but they keep imposing sanctions on that unfortunate country, which they destroyed by stirring a civil war there and by sending their foreign fighters from Libya, from other countries, which they encouraged these so-called free Syrian army and all these people. Their legacy is terrible. But
let me ask George something. Dima said something really interesting, is that Biden is being lionized in Europe. This is extraordinary. This entire Ukraine project has actually immiserated Europe, but Biden is lionized? George.
Yes.
It's even worse than that. He came to Germany to collect some kind of an award, and there are these photographs of the German president Steinmeier giving Biden an award. This is the man who destroyed your energy system. He destroyed the Nord Stream gas pipelines. This is why Germans are going to be freezing this winter. This is the man who helped decimate German industry, and Germany is giving him an award. It's the most abject, humiliating surrender imaginable. And this has really been the American policy. It's rendered Europe into this abject, supplicant condition, when Europe never had to do this. Europe could always have distanced itself from the United States. And it's led to these, you know, hundreds of thousands of lives lost. And the Americans turn around and say, well, if people are stupid enough to take this, then, hey, that's their problem. We're doing nicely.
Well, and on that note, we'll have to rely on future historians or psychologists. I'm not sure. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RTC. And next time, remember, Crosstalk Rules.